So where was the problem? I said. Geographically.
Two main places, Kelstein said. First, the Middle East. Joe believed there was a plant in the Bekaa Valley that turned out fake hundreds which were practically perfect. But there was very little he could do about it.
Have you been there?
I shook my head. I had been stationed in Beirut for a while. I had known a few people who had gone out to the Bekaa Valley for one reason or another. Not too many of them had come back.
Syrian controlled Lebanon, Kelstein said.
Joe called it the Badlands. They do everything there. Training camps for the world's terrorists, drug processing laboratories, you name it, they've got it, including a pretty good replica of our own Bureau of Printing and Engraving. I thought about it, thought about my time there.
Protected by who? I asked him.
Kelstein smiled at me again, nodded. A perceptive question, he said. You instinctively grasp that an operation of that size is so visible, so complex, that it must be in some way sponsored. Joe believed it was protected by, or maybe even owned by, the Syrian government. Therefore, his involvement was marginal. His conclusion was that the only solution was diplomatic. Failing that, he was in favor of airstrikes against it. We may live to see such a solution one day.
And the second place? I asked him.
He pointed his finger at his grimy office window, aiming south down Amsterdam Avenue. South America, he said. The second source is Venezuela. Joe had located it. That is what he was working on. Absolutely outstanding counterfeit $100 bills are coming out of Venezuela. But strictly private enterprise, no suggestion of government involvement. I nodded.
We got that far, I said. A guy called Kleiner, based down in Georgia where Joe was killed.
Quite so, Kelstein said. The ingenious Mr. Kleiner. It's his operation. He's running the whole thing. We knew that for certain.
How is he?
He's panicking, I said. He's killing people.
Kelstein nodded sadly.
We thought Kleiner might panic, he said. He's protecting an outstanding operation. The very best we've ever seen.
The best? I said. Kelstein nodded enthusiastically.
Outstanding, he said again. How much do you know about counterfeiting?
I shrugged at him.
More than I did last week, I said. But not enough, I guess.
Kelstein nodded and shifted his frail weight forward in his chair. His eyes lit up. He was about to start a lecture on his favorite subject.
There are two sorts of counterfeiters, he said. The bad ones and the good ones. The good ones do it properly. Do you know the difference between intaglio and lithography?
I shrugged and shook my head. Kelstein scooped up a magazine from a pile and handed it to me. It was a quarterly bulletin from a history society.
Open it, he said. Any page will do. Run your fingers over the paper. It's smooth, isn't it? That's lithographic printing. That's how virtually everything is printed. Books, magazines, newspapers, everything. An inked roller passes over the blank paper. But intaglio is different.
He suddenly clapped his hands together. I jumped.
The sound was very loud in his quiet office.
"That's Intaglia," he said.
"A metal plate
is smashed into the paper with considerable force.
It leaves a definite embossed feel to the product. The printed image looks three-dimensional. It feels three-dimensional. It's unmistakable."
He eased himself up and took his wallet out of his hip pocket, pulled out a $10 bill, passed it over to me.
"Can you feel it?" he asked. "The metal plates are nickel, coated with chromium. Fine lines are engraved into the chromium, and the lines are filled with ink. The plate hits the paper, and the ink is printed onto its topmost surface. Understand? The ink is in the valleys of the plate, so it's transferred to the ridges on the paper. Intaglio printing is the only way to get that raised image, the only way to make the forgery feel right. It's how the real thing is done."
"What about the ink?" I said.
"There are three colors," he said, "black and two greens. The back of the bill is printed first with the darker green. Then the paper is left to dry, and the next day the front is printed with the black ink. That dries, and the front is printed again with the lighter green. That's the other stuff you see there on the front, including the serial number. But the lighter green is printed by a different process, called letterpress. It's a stamping action, the same as Intaglio, but the ink is stamped into the valleys on the paper, not onto the peaks." I nodded and looked at the $10 bill front and back, ran my fingers over it carefully. I had never really studied one before.
"So, four problems," Kelstein said. "The press, the plates, the inks, and the paper. The press can be bought new or used anywhere in the world. There are hundreds of sources. Most countries print money and securities and bonds on them, so the press is obtainable abroad. They can even be improvised. Joe found one Intaglio operation in Thailand, which was using a converted squid processing machine. Their hundreds were absolutely immaculate."
"What about the plates?" I asked him.
"Plates are problem number two," he said. "But it's a matter of talent. There are people in the world who can forge old master paintings, and there are people who can play a Mozart piano concerto after hearing it once. And certainly, there are engravers who can reproduce banknotes. It's a perfectly logical proposition, isn't it? If a human being in Washington can engrave the original, certainly there's a human being somewhere else who can copy it. But they're rare. Really good copyists? Rarer still. There are a few in Armenia. The Thai operation using the squid processor got a Malaysian to make the plates."
"Okay," I said. "So Kleiner has bought a press and he's found an engraver. What about the inks?"
"The inks are problem number three," he said. "You can't buy anything vaguely like them in the U.S. Joe saw to that. But abroad, they're available. As I said, virtually every country in the world has its own banknote printing industry. And obviously Joe couldn't enforce his systems in every country in the world. So the inks are easy enough to find. The greens are only a question of color. They mix them and experiment until they get them right. The black ink is magnetic. Did you know that?"
I shook my head again, looked at the sawbuck closely. Kelstein smiled.
You can't see it, he said.
A liquid ferrous chemical is mixed with the black ink. That's how electronic money counters work. They scan the engraving down the center of the portrait, and the machine reads the signal it gives off, like a tape head reads the sounds on a music cassette.
And they can get that ink? I said.
Anywhere in the world, he said. Everybody uses it. We lag behind other countries. We don't like to admit we worry about counterfeiting.
I remembered what Molly had said. Faith and trust. I nodded.
The currency must look stable, Kelstein said. That's why we're so reluctant to change it. It's got to look reliable, solid, unchanging.
Turn that 10 over and take a look.
I looked at the green picture on the back of the 10. The Treasury building was standing in a deserted street. Only one car was driving past. It looked like a Model T Ford.
Hardly changed since 1929, Kelstein said. Psychologically, it's very important. We choose to put the appearance of dependability before security. It made Joel's job very difficult.
I nodded again.
Right, I said. So we've covered the press, the plates, and the inks. What about the paper?
Kelstein brightened up and clasped his small hands like we had reached the really interesting part.
Paper is problem number 4, he said. Actually, we should really say it's problem number 1. It's by far the biggest problem.
It's the thing Joe and I couldn't understand about Kleiner's operation.
Why not? I asked him.
Because their paper is perfect, he said. It's 100% perfect. Their paper is better than their printing, and that is absolutely unheard of.
He started shaking his great white head in wonderment, like he was lost in admiration for Kleiner's achievement. We sat there, knee to knee in the old armchairs in silence.
Perfect, I prompted him.
He nodded and started up with the lecture again.
It's unheard of, he said again. The paper is the hardest part of the whole process. Don't forget, we're not talking about some amateur thing here. We're talking about an industrial-scale operation. In a year, they're printing $4 billion worth of hundreds.
That many, I said, surprised.
$4 billion, he said again. About the same as the Lebanon operation. Those were Joel's figures. He was in a position to know. And that makes it inexplicable. $4 billion in hundreds is 40 million banknotes. That's a lot of paper.
That's a completely inexplicable amount of paper, Mr. Reacher.
And their paper is perfect.
What sort of paper would they need? I asked him. He reached over and took the $10 bill back from me, crumpled it, and pulled it and snapped it.
It's a blend of fibers, he said. Very clever and entirely unique. About 80% cotton, about 20% linen. No wood pulp in it at all. It's got more in common with the shirt on your back than with a newspaper, for instance. It's got a very clever chemical colorant in it to give it a unique cream tint. And it's got random red and blue polymer threads pulped in as fine as silk. Currency stock is wonderful paper. Durable. Lasts for years, won't come apart in water, hot or cold. Absolutely precise absorbency. Capable of accepting the finest engraving the plate makers can achieve.
So the paper would be difficult to copy, I said.
Virtually impossible, he said. In a way, it's so difficult to copy that even the official government supplier can't copy it. They have tremendous difficulty just keeping it consistent, batch to batch, and they're by far the most sophisticated papermaker in the entire world.
I ran it all through in my head. Press, plates, ink, and paper. So the paper supply is really the key to all this, I said. Kelstein nodded ruefully.
That was our conclusion, he said.
We agreed the paper supply was crucial, and we agreed we had no idea how they were managing it.
That's why I can't really help you. I couldn't help Joe, and I can't help you. I'm terribly sorry.
I looked at him. They've got a warehouse full of something, I said. Could that be paper? He snorted in derision, snapped his great head around toward me.
Don't you listen, he said.
Currency stock is unobtainable. Completely unobtainable. You couldn't get 40 sheets of currency stock, never mind 40 million sheets.
The whole thing is a total mystery.
Joe and Walter and I racked our brains for a year, and we came up with nothing. I think Bartholomew came up with something, I said. Kelstein nodded sadly. He levered himself slowly out of his chair and stepped to his desk, pressed the replay button on his telephone answering machine. The room was filled with an electronic beep, then with the sound of a dead man's voice.
Kelstein, the voice said. Bartholomew here. It's Thursday night, late. I'm going to call you in the morning, and I'm going to tell you the answer. I knew I'd beat you to it. Good night, old man.
The voice had excitement in it. Kelstein stood there and gazed into space as if Bartholomew's spirit was hanging there in the still air. He looked upset. I couldn't tell if that was because his old colleague was dead or because his old colleague had beaten him to the answer.
Poor Walter, he said. I knew him 56 years.
I sat quietly for a spell. Then I stood up as well. I'll figure it out, I said. Kelstein put his head on one side and looked at me sharply.
Do you really think you will, he said,
when Joe couldn't? I shrugged at the old guy. Maybe Joe did, I said. We don't know what he had figured out before they got him. Anyway, right now I'm going back to Georgia. Carry on the search. Kelstein nodded and sighed. He looked stressed.
Good luck, Mr. Reacher, he said. I hope you finish your brother's business.
Perhaps you will. He spoke of you often.
He liked you, you know.
He spoke of me, I said.
Often, the old guy said again. He was very fond of you. He was sorry your job kept you so far away.
For a moment I couldn't speak. I felt unbearably guilty.
Years would pass. I wouldn't think about him. But he was thinking about me. He was older, but you looked after him, he said. That's what Joe told me. He said, You were very fierce. Very tough. I guess if Joe wanted anybody to take care of the Kleiners, he'd have nominated you.
I nodded. I'm out of here, I said. I shook his frail hand and left him with the cops in the security office. I was trying to figure where Kleiner was getting his perfect paper, and I was trying to figure if I could get the 6 o'clock flight back to Atlanta if I hurried, and I was trying to ignore what Kelstein had told me about Joe speaking fondly of me. The streets were clogged, and I was busy thinking about it all and scanning for an empty cab, which was why I didn't notice two Hispanic guys strolling up to me. But what I did notice was the gun the leading guy showed me. It was a small automatic held in a small hand, concealed under one of those khaki raincoats city people carry on their arms in September. He showed me the weapon, and his partner signaled to a car waiting 20 yards away at the curb. The car lurched forward, and the partner stood ready to open a door, like the top-hatted guys do outside the extensive apartment houses up there. I was looking at the gun and looking at the car, making choices.
"Get into the car," the guy with the gun said softly, "or I'll shoot you."
I stood there, and all that was passing through my mind was that I might miss my flight. I was trying to remember when the next nonstop left. 7 o'clock, I thought.
"In the car," the guy said again.
I was pretty sure he wouldn't fire the gun on the street. It was a small gun, but there was no silencer on it. It would make a hell of a noise, and it was a crowded street. The other guy's hands were empty. He maybe had a gun in his pocket. There was just the driver in the car, probably a gun on the seat beside him. I was unarmed. My jacket with the blackjack and the knife and the Desert Eagle was 800 miles away in Atlanta. Choices. I chose not to get into the car. I just stood there in the street, gambling with my life that the guy wouldn't shoot in public. He stood there, holding the raincoat out toward me. The car stopped next to us. His partner stood on the other side of me. They were small guys. The both of them wouldn't have made one of me. The car waited, idling at the curb. Nobody moved. We were just frozen there, like some kind of a display in a store window, like new fashions for the fall, old army fatigues put with Burberry raincoats. It gave the two guys a big problem. In a situation like that, there's a split-second opportunity to carry out your threat. If you say you're going to shoot, you've got to shoot. If you don't, you're a spent force. Your bluff is called. If you don't shoot, you're nothing. And the guy didn't shoot. He just stood there, twisted up with indecision. People swirled around us on the busy sidewalk. Cars were blasting their horns at the guy stopped at the curb. They were smart guys. Smart enough not to shoot me on a busy New York street. Smart enough to know I had called their bluff. Smart enough to never again make a threat they weren't going to keep, but not smart enough to walk away. They just stood there. So I swayed backward as if I was going to take a step away. The gun under the raincoat prodded forward at me. I tracked the movement and grabbed the little guy's wrist with my left hand, pulled the gun around behind me, and hugged the guy close with my right arm around his shoulders. We looked like we were dancing the waltz together, or we were lovers at a train station. Then I fell forward and crushed him against the car. All the time I was squeezing his wrist as hard as I could with my nails dug in. Left-handed, but it was hurting him. My weight, leaning up on him, was giving him a struggle to breathe. His partner still had his hand on the car door. His glance was darting back and forth. Then his other hand was going for his pocket. So I jackknifed my weight back and rolled around my guy's gun hand and threw him against the car, and then I ran like hell. In 5 strides, I was lost in the crowd. I dodged and barged my way through the mass of people, ducked in and out of doorways, and ran through shrieking and honking traffic across the streets. The 2 guys stayed with me for a spell, but the traffic eventually stopped them. They weren't taking the risks I was taking. I got a cab 8 blocks away from where I had started and made the 6 o'clock non-stop LaGuardia to Atlanta. Going back, it took longer for some reason. I was sitting there for 2.5 hours. I thought about Joe all the way through the airspace above Jersey, Maryland, and Virginia, above the Carolinas and into Georgia. I thought about Roscoe. I wanted her back. I missed her like crazy. We came down through storm clouds 10 miles thick. The Atlanta evening gloom was turned to pitch black by the clouds. Looked like an enormous weather system was rolling in from somewhere. When we got off the plane, the air in the little tunnel was thick and heavy and smelled of storm as well as kerosene. I picked up the Bentley key from the information counter in the arrivals hall. It was in an envelope with a parking claim. I walked out to find the car. Felt a warm wind blowing out of the north. The storm was going to be a big one. I could feel the voltage building up for the lightning. I found the car in the short-term lot. The rear windows were all tinted black. The guy hadn't gotten around to doing the front side glass or the windshield. It made the car look like something royalty might use, with a chauffeur driving them. My jacket was laid out in the trunk. I put it on and felt the reassuring weight of the weaponry in the pockets again. I got in the driver's seat and nosed out of the lot and headed south down the highway in the dark. It was 9 o'clock Friday evening. Maybe 36 hours before they could start shipping the stockpile out on Sunday. It was 10 o'clock when I got back to Margrave. 35 hours to go. I had spent the hour thinking about some stuff we had learned back in Staff College. We had studied military philosophies, mostly written by those old krauts who loved all that stuff. I hadn't paid much attention, but I remember some big thing which said, sooner or later you've got to engage the enemy's main force. You don't win the war unless you do that. Sooner or later, you seek out their main force, and you take it on, and you destroy it. I knew their main force had started with 10 people. Hubble had told me that. Then there were 9 after they ditched Morrison. I knew about the 2 Kleiners, Teal and Baker. That left me 5 more names to find. I smiled to myself, pulled off the county road into Eno's gravel lot, parked up on the far end of the row and got out, stretched and yawned in the night air. The storm was holding off, but it was going to break. The air was still thick and heavy. I could still feel the voltage in the clouds. I could still feel the warm wind on my back. I got into the back of the car, stretched out on the leather bench, and went to sleep. I wanted to get an hour and a half. I started dreaming about John Lee Hooker in the old days, before he got famous again. He had an old steel-strung guitar, played it sitting on a little stool. The stool was placed on a square of wooden board. He used to press old beer bottle caps into the soles of his shoes to make them noisy, like homemade tap shoes. He'd sit on his stool and play that guitar with his bold, choppy style, all the while pounding on the wooden board with his noisy shoes. I was dreaming of him pounding out the rhythm with his shoes on that old board. But it wasn't John Lee's shoes making the noise. It was somebody knocking on the Bentley's windshield. I snapped awake and struggled up. Sergeant Baker was looking in at me. The big chrome clock on the dash showed 10:30. I'd slept a half hour. That was all I was going to get. First thing I did was to change my plan. A much better one had fallen right into my lap. The old Krauts would have approved. Tactical flexibility was big with them. Second thing I did was to put my hand in my pocket and snick the safety off the Desert Eagle. Then I got out of the opposite door and looked along the car roof at Baker. He was using his friendly grin, gold tooth and all. "How you doing?" he said. "Sleeping in a public place? Around here you could get arrested for vagrancy." I grinned a friendly grin right back at him. "Highway safety," I said. "They tell you don't drive if you're tired. Pull off and take a nap, right?" "Come on in, and I'll buy you a cup of coffee," he said. "You want to wake up, Eno's coffee should do it for you." I locked the car, kept my hand in my pocket. We crunched over the gravel and into the diner, slid into the end booth. The woman with the glasses brought us coffee. We hadn't asked, she just seemed to know.
"So, how you doing?" Baker said. "Feeling bad about your brother?"
I shrugged at him, drank my coffee left-handed. My right hand was wrapped around the Desert Eagle in my pocket. "We weren't close," I said. Baker nodded.
"Roscoe still helping the Bureau out?" he said.
"Guess so," I said.
"And where's old Finley tonight?"
he asked. "Jacksonville," I said. "He had to go to Florida to check something out."
"Jacksonville?" he said. "What does he need to check out in Jacksonville?"
I shrugged again, sipped my coffee.
"Search me," I said. "He doesn't tell me anything. I'm not on the payroll. I'm just an errand boy. Now he's got me running up to Hubble's place to fetch him something."
"Hubble's place," Baker said. "What you got to fetch from there?"
"Some old papers," I said. "Anything I can find, I guess."
"Then what?" he said. "You going to Florida, too?"
I shook my head, sipped more coffee. "Finley told me to stick them in the mail," I said. "Some Washington address. I'm going to sleep up at Hubble's place and mail them in the morning."
Baker nodded slowly. Then he flashed his friendly grin again, but it was forced.
We finished up our coffee. Baker dropped a couple of bucks on the table, and we slid out and left. He got into his patrol car, waved at me as he drove off. I let him go ahead and strolled over the gravel to the Bentley. I rolled south to the end of the dark little town and made the right turn up Beckman Drive.
26. I had to be very careful about where I put the Bentley. I wanted it to look like it was just casually dumped, but it had to be left so nobody could get past it. I inched it back and forth for a while, left it at the top of Hubble's driveway with the wheels turned away. It looked like I had driven up in a hurry and just slewed to a stop. I wanted the house to look like I was in there. Nothing is more obvious than an empty building. That quiet, abandoned look is a giveaway. There's a stillness, no human vibrations. So I opened the front door with the key from the big bunch Charlie had given me, walked through, and turned on some random lights. In the den, I switched the television set on and left it at a low murmur. Same thing with the radio in the kitchen. Pulled a few drapes, went back outside. It looked pretty good. Looked like there might be someone in there. Then the first stop was the coat closet off the main hallway. I was looking for gloves. Not easy to find in the Sun Belt. Not much call for them. But Hubble had some. Two pairs, lying neatly on a shelf. One was a pair of ski gloves, lime green and lilac.
Not much good to me. I wanted something dark. The other pair was what I wanted. Dressy things and thin black leather. Banker's gloves. Very soft, like a second skin. The ski gloves made me look for a hat. If the Hubbles had taken trips up to Colorado, they'd have had all the gear. I found a box of hats. There was a kind of watch cap in there, some sort of a synthetic fiber. The bottom part rolled down to make ear flaps. The hat was printed up in a dark green pattern. It would do. Next stop was the master bedroom. I found Charlie's vanity table. It was bigger than some of the rooms I had lived in. She had a mess of cosmetics, all kinds of things. I took a tube of waterproof mascara into the bathroom, smeared it all over my face. Then I fastened the jacket, put on the hat, put on the gloves. I walked back into the bedroom and checked the result in the full-length mirrors on the closet doors. Not bad. Just about right for night work. I went back outside, locked up the front door again. I could feel the huge storm clouds clamping down overhead. It was very dark. I stood by the front door and checked myself over, put the pistol in the inside jacket pocket, moved the zip down and checked the draw. Came out okay. Loaded, cocked, safety on. Spare shells in the outside top right pocket, switchblade in the left side pocket, blackjack in the right side pocket, shoes tightly laced. I walked down the driveway away from the house, past the parked Bentley 12 or 15 yards, pushed through the greenery and settled in a spot where I could just about see up and down the drive. I sat on the cold earth and got ready to wait. In an ambush situation, waiting is what wins the battle. If the other guy is wary, he'll come early or late, when he figures you won't be expecting him. So however early he might make it, you've got to be ready earlier. However late he might leave it, you've got to wait it out. You wait in a kind of trance. You need infinite patience. No use fretting or worrying. You just wait. Doing nothing, thinking nothing, burning no energy. Then you burst into action. After an hour, 5 hours, a day, a week. Waiting is a skill like anything else. It was a quarter to midnight when I settled in for the wait. I could feel the storm boiling up overhead. The air was like soup. It was pitch dark. About midnight, the storm broke. Heavy drops, the size of quarters, spattered the leaves around me. They built into a deluge within seconds. It was like sitting in a shower stall. Awesome thunderclaps crashed about. They ripped and banged, and the lightning blazed in sheets. The garden around me was lit up like day for seconds at a time. I sat under the lashing rain and waited. 10 minutes. 15. They came for me at 20 minutes past midnight. The rain was still bad, and the thunder was still crashing and rolling. I didn't hear their truck until it was well up the driveway. I heard it crunching over the gravel about 40 feet away. It was a dark green panel truck, gold lettering, Kleiner Foundation, like the one I'd seen near Roscoe's place on Tuesday morning. It crunched past me about 6 feet away, wide tires on the gravel. That's what Finley had seen up at the Morrison place, marks in the gravel made by wide tires. The truck stopped a few yards beyond me. It pulled up sharp, just behind the Bentley. Couldn't get past, just where I wanted it. I heard the engine stop and the parking brake ratchet on. First guy out was the driver. He was wearing a white nylon bodysuit. It had a hood pulled tight around his face. Over his face was a surgical mask. He was wearing thin rubber gloves. On his feet, rubber overshoes. He vaulted out of the driver's seat and walked around to the rear doors. I knew that walk. I knew that tall, heavy build. I knew those long, powerful arms. It was the Kleiner kid. The Kleiner kid himself had come to kill me. He slapped his palm on the rear door. It made a hollow boom. Then he turned the handle and opened up. Four men came out, all dressed the same. White nylon bodysuits, hoods pulled tight, masks, gloves, rubber overshoes. Two were carrying bags. Two had long, fat shotguns. A total of five men. I'd expected four. Five was going to be harder, but more productive. The rain was lashing down on them. I could hear the brittle spatter as it hit their stiff nylon suits. I could hear the metallic clang as the heavy drops bounced off the roof of their truck. I saw them caught by a lightning flash. They looked like banshees, like something escaped from hell. They were a terrifying sight. For the first time, I doubted if I would have beaten them on Monday night. But I was going to beat them tonight. Tonight, I would have the advantage of surprise. I would be an invisible nightmare figure let loose among them. The Kleiner kid was organizing them. He reached into the back of the truck and pulled out a crowbar, pointed to three of his soldiers, and walked off with them through the downpour to the house. The fifth guy was going to wait with the truck. Because of the rain, he was going to get back in the cab. I saw him glance up at the black sky and glance forward at the driver's seat. I pulled out the sap, forced my way through the bushes. The guy couldn't hear me. The rain was roaring in his ears. He turned his back and took a step toward the driver's door. I shut my eyes for a second and pictured Joe lying on the slab at the morgue, with no face. Pictured Roscoe shaking with horror as she stared at the footprints on her hallway floor. Then I crashed out of the bushes, skipped up behind the guy, smashed the sap across the back of his skull. It was a big sap, and I gave it all I had. I felt the bone explode under it. The guy went down on the gravel like a tree. He lay face down, and the rain hammered on his nylon suit. I broke his neck with a single mighty kick. One down. I dragged the body across the gravel and left it at the back of the truck, walked around and pulled the keys out of the ignition, crept on up to the house. I put the sap back in my pocket, popped the switchblade, and carried it in my right hand. I didn't want to use the gun in the house, too noisy, even with the thunder crashing outside. I stopped inside the front door. The lock was forced, and the wood was splintered. I saw the crowbar on the hallway floor. It was a big house. It was going to take them some time to search it. My guess was they'd stick together as a group of four. They'd search together. Then they'd split up. I could hear them tramping through the upper floor. I stepped back outside to wait for one of them to come down into the hallway. I waited, pressed against the wall, next to the broken door. I was sheltered by the overhang of the roof. The rain was still torrential. It was as bad as a tropical storm. I waited nearly 5 minutes before the first one came downstairs. I heard the creak of his tread in the hallway, heard him open the coat closet door. I stepped inside the house. His back was to me. He was one of the shotgun carriers, tall, lighter than me. I fell in behind him, reached over the top of his head with my left hand, stuck my fingers in his eyes. He dropped the shotgun and thudded under the carpet. I pulled him backward and turned him and ran him out through the door, into the downpour, dug my fingers deeper into his eyes, hauled his head back, cut his throat. You don't do it with one elegant swipe, not like in the movies. No knife is sharp enough for that. There is all kinds of tough gristle in the human throat. You have to saw back and forth with a lot of strength. Takes a while, but it works. It works well. By the time you've sawed back to the bone, the guy is dead. This guy was no exception. His blood hosed out and mixed with the rain. He sagged against my grip. Two down. I dragged the body over to the lawn by the top of his hood. No good picking him up under the knees and shoulders. His head would have lolled back and fallen off. I left him on the grass, ran back inside, picked up the shotgun and grimaced. It was a serious weapon, an Ithaca Mag 10. I'd seen them in the army. They fire an enormous cartridge. People call them the roadblocker. There's enough power in them to kill people through the side of a soft-skinned vehicle. Face to face, they're devastating. They only hold 3 cartridges, but like we used to say, by the time you've fired 3 rounds, the battle is definitely over. I kept the blade out as my weapon of choice. Silent. But the shotgun would be better than the Desert Eagle as backup. Thing is, with a shotgun, aiming is a luxury. A shotgun sprays a wide cone of lead. With a Mag 10, as long as it's pointed vaguely in the right direction, you're going to score. I stepped back out through the splintered door and pressed against the wall, out of the deluge. I waited. Now my guess was they'd start coming out of the house. They wouldn't find me in there, and they'd miss the guy I had just dropped, so they'd start coming out. It was inevitable. They couldn't stay in there forever. I waited. 10 minutes. I could hear creaking from the floor inside. Ignored it. Sooner or later, they'd come out. They came out. 2 guys together. They came as a pair. That made me hesitate a fraction. They stepped out into the downpour, and I heard the rain start roaring against their nylon hoods. I pulled out the sap again, swapped it into my right hand. The first guy went down easily enough. I caught him square on the back of his neck with the heavy sap, and his head nearly came off. But the second guy reacted and twisted away so that I missed with the next swing. The sap just smashed his collarbone and dropped him to his knees. I stabbed him left-handed in the face, lined up for another shot with the sap. Took me 2 more blows to break his neck. He was a wiry guy, but not wiry enough. 4 down. I dragged the 2 bodies through the lashing rain to the lawn at the edge of the gravel drive, piled them with the other guy. I had 4 down and 1 shotgun captured, the truck keys in my pocket, the Kleiner kid with his shotgun still on the loose. I couldn't find him. I didn't know where he was. I stepped into the house out of the rain and listened. Couldn't hear a thing. The roar of the rain on the roof and on the gravel outside was too much. It was putting up a mask of white noise over everything else. If the kid was alerted and creeping around, I wouldn't hear him. It was going to be a problem. I crept into the garden room. The rain was hammering on the roof. I stood still and listened hard. Heard the kid in the hallway. He was on his way out. He was going out the front door. If he turned right, he was going to trip over his 3 dead grunts piled on the lawn. But he turned left. He walked past the garden room windows. He was headed across the soaking lawn to the patio area. I watched him walk by, through the deluge, maybe 8 feet away. Looked like a ghost from hell. A ghost from hell holding a long black shotgun out in front of him. I had the garden room key in my pocket, on the Bentley ring. I unlocked the door and stepped out. The rain hit me like a drenching from a fire hose. I crept around to the patio. The Kleiner kid was standing there, looking down toward the big swimming pool. I crouched in the rain and watched him. From 20 feet, I could hear the downpour thrashing against his white nylon bodysuit. Lightning was searing the sky, and the thunder was a continuous crashing. I didn't want to shoot him with the Mag 10 I was holding. I had to dispose of the bodies. I had to leave old man Kleiner unsettled. I had to keep him guessing about what had happened, about where his boy had
disappeared to. It would unbalance him, and it was crucial to my own safety. I couldn't afford to leave the slightest shred of evidence behind. Using the big Ithaca against the kid would make a hell of a mess. Disposing of his body would be a severe problem. Finding all of it would be difficult. I waited. The kid set off down the long sloping lawn to the pool. I looped around, staying on the wet grass. The kid walked slowly. He was worried. He was on his own. His vision wasn't good. The tight hood around his face was limiting his field of view. He kept turning his head from side to side, stiff-necked, like a mechanical thing. He stopped at the edge of the pool. I was a yard behind him. I was swaying left and right, staying out of the edge of his vision as he swung his gaze from side to side. His massive shotgun was traversing left and right over the teeming pool. The books I used to read, the movies people see, I should have fought him nobly. I was here to stand up for my brother, and right in front of me was a guy who had kicked his body around like a bundle of rags. We should have duked it out, face to face. He should have been made aware of who his opponent was. He should have been made aware of why he had to die. All that noble man-to-man stuff. But real life wasn't like that. Joe would have laughed at all that. I swung the sap with all my strength at his head, just as he turned to walk back to the house. The sap glanced off the slick nylon, and the momentum of the heavy lead-filled tube pulled me hopelessly off balance. I was falling like a man on ice. The kid spun and raised the shotgun, pumped a shell into the chamber. I flung my arm up and knocked the barrel aside, rolled right under his field of fire. He squeezed the trigger, and there was an enormous explosion, louder than the worst of the thunder. I heard leaves tearing and ripping as the shot smashed into the trees beyond us. The ferocious recoil rocked him back, but he pumped the second shell. I heard the menacing double crunch-crunch of the mechanism. I was on my back on the poolside tiles, but I lunged up and grabbed the gun with both hands, forced the barrel up and the stock down, and he fired into the air again. Another terrifying explosion. This time I pulled with the recoil and tore the gun out of his hands, thrust up and jabbed the stock at his face. It was a poor blow. The Ithaca has a big rubber pad on the stock. It protects the shooter's shoulder from the savage recoil. Now it protected the kid's head from my jab. He just rocked back. I dove at his legs and slammed him backward, swiped at his feet and tripped him into the pool. He splashed in on his back. I jumped in on top of him. We were in the deep end of the pool, thrashing about for the winning hold. The rain was hammering. Chlorine was burning my eyes and nose. I fought on until I got his throat, tore the nylon hood back and got my hands right on his neck, locked my arms, and thrust the kid's head far under the water. I was crushing his throat with all my strength. That biker in Warburton had thought he was doing a job on me, but that had been like a lover's caress compared to what I was doing to the Kleiner kid. I was tearing his head off. I squeezed and wrenched and held him a yard underwater until he died. Didn't take long. Never does in that situation. The first guy under stays under. It could have been me. I was treading water and gasping through the chlorine stink. The rain was chopping up the surface. It was impossible to tell where the water ended and the air began. I let his body float off and swam to the side, clung on and got my breath. The weather was a nightmare. The thunder was now a continuous roar, and the lightning blazed in sheets. The rain was a relentless downpour. It would have kept me drier to stay in the pool, but I had things to do.
I swam back to fetch the kid's body. It was floating a yard down. I towed it back to the side, hauled myself out, grabbed a bunch of nylon in each hand and dragged the body out after me. It weighed a ton. It lay on the pool side with water gushing out of the suit at the wrists and ankles. I left it there and staggered back up toward the garage. Walking was not easy. My clothes were soaking wet and cold. It was like walking in chainmail. But I made it to the garage and found the key, unlocked the door, and hit the light. It was a three-car garage, just the other Bentley in there. Hubble's own car, same vintage as Charlie's. Gorgeous, dark green, lovingly polished to a deep gloss. I could see my reflection in the paint as I moved about. I was looking for a wheelbarrow or a garden truck, whatever gardeners use. The garage was full of garden gear, a big ride-on mower, hoses, tools. In the far corner, a sort of a barrow thing with big spoke wheels like a bicycle. I wheeled it out into the storm and down to the pool, scrabbled around, and found the two shotguns and the wet sap. Dropped the shotguns in the barrel and put the sap back in my pocket. Checked that the kid's corpse still had its shoes on and heaved it into the barrel. Wheeled it up to the house and down the driveway. Squeezed it past the Bentley and rolled it around to the back of the truck. I opened the rear doors and heaved the corpse inside. Scrambled up and dragged it well in. The rain was clattering on the roof. Then I lifted the first guy's body in and dragged it up next to the Kleiner kit, threw the shotguns in on top of them. Two stowed. Then I took the barrow up to where I had piled the other three. They were sprawled on the soaking lawn with the rain roaring on their hideous suits. I wheeled them back to the truck they had come in, got all five laid out inside. Then I ran the barrow back through the deluge to the garage, put it back in the corner where I had found it, took a flashlight from the workbench. I wanted to get a look at the four boys young Kleiner had brought with him. I ran back through the rain to the truck and stepped up inside, switched on the flashlight, and crouched over the forlorn row of corpses. The Kleiner kid, I knew. The other four, I pulled back their hoods and tore away their masks, played the flashlight beam over their faces. Two of them were the gate men from the warehouse. I had watched them through the field glasses on Thursday, and I was sure of it. Maybe I wouldn't have sworn to it in a court-martial, but I wasn't interested in that kind of a judicial procedure tonight. The other two, I did know for sure. No doubt about it. They were police. They were the backup crew from Friday. They'd come with Baker and Stevenson to the diner to arrest me. I'd seen them around the station house a few times since. They had been inside the scam. More of Mayor Thiel's concealed troops. I scrambled out of the truck again and took the flashlight back to the garage, locked up the doors and ran through the rain to the front of the house. Scooped up the two bags they had brought, dumped them inside Hubble's hallway, and hit the light. Looked through the bags. Spare gloves and masks, a box of 10-gauge shotgun shells, a hammer, a bag of 6-inch nails, and four knives. Medical type of thing. They could cut you just looking at them. I picked up the crowbar from where they had dropped it after breaking the lock. Put it in one of the bags, carried the bags down to the truck and hurled them in on top of the five bodies. Then I shut and locked the rear doors and ran through the lashing rain up to the house again. I ran through and locked up the garden room, ran back to the kitchen. I opened the oven door and emptied my pockets, laid everything out on the floor, found a couple of baking sheets in the next cupboard. I stripped down the Desert Eagle and laid the parts carefully on one of the trays, piled the spare bullets next to them, put the knife, the sap,
the Bentley keys and my money and papers on the other.